Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio on this wonderful blue day in February 2020. I'm taking my constitutional, I'm walking around the Garn, Barmouth Mountain we call it sometimes. I'm just around the back of the hill. You hear that lovely little stream down there. And today, I think I'll just do a short podcast about a book I've just recently read, a kind of book review that I recommend that you read. And if you look back over the podcast, you'll notice I do this occasionally. I did something about Michael Hudson's Junkie Economics. And I've been reading quite a bit of stuff at the moment. Sort of political, economic nature. The one that I want to just give a brief shout out for is a book called Giants. It's by Peter Phillips, who's a professor in America. He's an academic. And Giants is an investigation of the huge financial corporations that straddle the globe, in fact operate in all countries on the globe. And there's a lot of detail in the book. It's quite weighty, and everything's referenced. I'm not trying to get you into any kind of daft conspiracy theories. This is all good, solid stuff that can be double checked. Now, the main thesis is that there is an enormous concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a very few people. You will have heard me say this numerous times throughout these podcasts. If you're one of the few fans that listens to them, that concentrations of wealth become concentrations of power, and we need to think about it like that and understand how that works. And to actually dive into the empirical facts, into the actualities and the nuances. And and this means the relationships between entities and institutions, and between politics and public discourse, and actual systems of money and trade and so forth. So it does become sort of quite intricate and complex. And I'll suggest in a little bit that this book needs to be read in conjunction with some other books for a nice detailed picture. Now, I'm not going to sweat the detail in this podcast, because you can get the book and read it. The central fact which structures Phillips's book is the fact that 17 asset management corporations exist, and they deal with over $1 trillion of assets. In other words, these are people who look after people's wealth and money for them and invest. They kind of basically, their power derives from where they decide to invest, what they decide to invest in, because that will translate into jobs in certain localities and into certain products over and against others, certain projects over and against others, and so forth. Now, there are 17 of these corporations with $1 trillion each to play with. This is the figure for 2017. It may have changed a little bit since then. We know 2020. Phillips's figures are for 2017. Now, the total assets of the 17 companies come to $41.1 trillion. This is an enormous, almost unimaginable amount of capital. I mean, I'll name some of these groups because this is what Phillips does. He names them and gives you quite a lot of detail that's in the public domain about these corporations. The biggest one is BlackRock. At the time that Phillips was writing, the CEO was Laddie Fink. Other corporations that you might be familiar with: Barclays, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Capital Group, which incidentally Theresa May, ex-UK Prime Minister's husband, works for. And as I say, Phillips gives us a list of the companies. He then demonstrates how these companies are linked together, in as much as they invest in each other. So if you have any kind of romance about capitalist competition and what a wonderful thing it is, these guys right at the top of the pyramid just invest in each other's companies. Every company's got some kind of holding in the other one. Phillips also tells us what the main investments are. And there's obviously a lot of stuff in the military-industrial complex, you know, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, BAE, etc. And you can see what the kind of investment pattern is in these corporations. Now, then it gets more interesting when Phillips identifies 199 directors of these corporations, and of course he names them. And gives all their CVs, so you know, he'll tell you where they're educated, what other companies they've worked for, what posts they've held in governments, which in some cases they've held posts in government or in the civil service of governments. And he amply demonstrates the revolving door between government and this high-level finance capital. He also tells you where these people have got positions in sort of think tanks and institutions that advise, act as networking hubs, produce policy documents and so forth, like the Group of 30, the G30, and the Trilateral Commission and the Council for Foreign Relations, and so on. And of course, again, there's a great entanglement and revolving door involving these institutions. So this is very detailed. The general picture is that most of these guys are guys, they're men, and they're white, and they're not all American. There's a lot of Americans, and the majority are Americans. It's very common for such people to hold higher degrees from Ivy League or Oxford. You know, it's a common picture, you know, Harvard, Oxford, Stanford, MIT, and so forth, and master's degrees, MBAs, PhDs, a lot of PhDs. And they're not daft, or at least they have academic ability as a group. Largely speaking, there's a few other people. There's some Kuwaitis and some Indians and so forth, and Europeans. The British are in there. I think you'll find people have held posts in the Bank of England and so forth. And you can see what a web it is, a cabal, you might say. Now, that's all very interesting, and as I say, you can go through it, and he spares no detail, and he gives references as to where this information can be double-checked. And it's self-evident that this small group, 199 directors, disposing of $41.1 trillion of capital worldwide. They operate in pretty well all countries. There are very few places they're not in operation. I don't know how their stuff goes down in North Korea, but everywhere else they're in action. Now, another thing that I want to mention is that there's a lot of this investment goes into tech giants, FAMGA, you know, Facebook, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon. So another vital part of the skeleton of global finance capital, as mapped out by Phillips, is the propaganda companies. Now, globally, three groups pretty well own most of the propaganda companies. These include all the huge global press corporations and so on, and he maps that out too in a similar fashion. Calls these groups Public Relations and Propaganda Corporations, PRP, Public Relations and Propaganda. And this is about controlling information worldwide again. Now, I'm sure you'll have heard me say this if you've been listening to these podcasts. You know, if you control information, you control the world. Well, our transnational capitalist class is aware of that very point. The 17 corporations invest heavily in the three main propaganda groupings. But not only do they invest heavily in them, they also employ them. Obviously, they want to control the way they're perceived by the peoples of the world. And it's an expedient move on their part to both invest in and employ the media. Now, there's a lot more in the book than I'm talking about. There's also like a second tier of investment corporations who run at under a trillion. But some of these, there's quite a handful of these doing 900 billion of business, you know, and so forth. So it gives us more details. It's a very, very detailed picture. And there's absolutely no doubt that a lot of the power lies here. And of course, PR firms also are like lobbying firms, you know. And of course, we've got the revolving door with the government and government agencies and the think tanks that can influence governments and political parties. All of this has somehow been captured. Well, really, very few people. And at the core of this is control of the wealth that's going to be invested to make things happen, to enable the productive activity of the world. And then coupled with that, and completely entangled with it again in the same fashion, is the control of information. And this book gives you a sense of what you're up against. I mean, we saw him in action against Jeremy Corbyn with the propaganda. And to my mind, that is really the people who are saying, oh, well, you know, just move a bit to the right and then you'll get in. Then you might get elected, because after all, you've got great policies that people like. I think this is ridiculous. When you understand what the media is and how it's positioned in this cabal and matrix of concentration of wealth and power. The left needs to establish as fast as it can its own media. Now, this is already happening with some excellent independent media on the internet. But of course, the tech companies who are in the game, and probably more in the game than Phillips emphasises, also are controlling the actual pipe work of the internet and so forth. You know, you hear of somebody doing a bit of a left-wing analysis of the economy, the American economy or something, and they can get kind of demonetized by YouTube and so forth. But I think finding outlets on the internet, getting our own servers, getting our own infrastructure, even if you listen to somebody like Brendan Smetana, alias Synth, you might understand how this can be done and will be done. In fact, he's being done. Now in the UK we've got probably 5 years of Boris Johnson, but that should be time to get some a range of media outlets and a bit of competence in using the same dirty tricks as the data scientists are using to manipulate elections in the manner of Cambridge Analytica. But expecting that you'll somehow get like a reasonable deal from the mainstream media, and in fact a reasonable deal from the transnational capitalist class, it's just not going to happen. Then they've got too much at stake and they've got an immense power, and unless you make some hefty concessions, you're going to get nowhere. This all makes me wonder what Tony Blair offered Murdoch. But I think with hindsight we can see, you know, that there was no union, no reversal of the union reforms that Mrs. Thatcher brought about. In other words, I think Murdoch must have said, you can't let the trade unions get power again. Of course, Murdoch clashed with the trade unions when the print industry, you know, when the newspaper industry changed through technology and so forth. And Blair removed Clause 4, and that might have been what he said, remove Clause 4 from the Labour Party constitution. So Clause 4 is a commitment to the collective ownership of the means of production. Blair got it removed from the Labour Party. He changed the Labour Party very, very fundamentally by doing that. This is why Mrs. Thatcher called Tony Blair and New Labour her best achievement. Because basically they kind of cut the balls off of socialism in the UK. And this, you need to be very cognizant of this if you're starting to think, oh well, let's elect somebody acceptable. Let's concede a few things and then we'll get a few things. I don't think this is the way to go. To think like that is a failure to understand quite what you're up against, and Peter Phillips' book I think does an excellent job of showing us that. Now I'm going to say about the book that all that detail and that research, it's kind of marvellous. But I'm a bit disappointed in Phillips at the end of the book. His kind of conclusion seems to be that, well, let's reform capitalism. There might be some way of reforming it. I don't think it's reformable. Having said that, I don't think that's a reason for not getting what we can now. And I kind of fairly sympathetic to Yanis Varoufakis's view is that capitalism needs to be stabilised and then we can go past it, we can transcend it somehow. But there needs to be some kind of bit of stability brought to bear in the short term. And I do keep saying this, revolution great, but don't destroy your infrastructure. There's a lot of people on the planet who depend on it. And stabilising capitalism, I think, it should be fairly urgent in the short term. If that were at all possible, but not making that your final goal. Here's capitalism. Let's just kind of fix it. It just needs a tweak. It's just gone off course a little bit. And there is a sort of utopian capitalism. I think even the neoliberal take of Hayek, Buchanan, Friedman and so on, and the way this gets popularised is to say, oh well, capitalism's fine, we just haven't got the real capitalism. And there's a utopianism there, isn't there, just lurking under the surface there. There's a fantasy that the free market will magically look after everything. And it is a fantasy, it's magical thinking. There's never been a free market. And the attempts to produce one have crashed the economy in 2008. We're paying the price with austerity and all the rest of it. So it's a bit disappointing vis-a-vis his vision. Maybe he's being realistic and I'm being hippie-ish and utopian. But I think not. But the way he just takes the lid off the actual detail, the actual workings, is really rather marvellous. Okay, so I'm following on reading that book with a book that's very popular at the moment. It's called Living in the Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. And this is a big thick thing, it's getting on for 700 pages. And I'm a good way into it, and it's absolutely fascinating. And this takes the lid off Google and Facebook and the monetization of data and the discovery that you can use the technology and the information that you mine and extract from people who use the service, Facebook, Gmail, whatever, Google search. And use it to predict behaviours. So you've got this kind of predictive ability that you can sell to advertisers, including political parties. And there's a lot of detail about how all this works. And again, it's detailed, it's rigorous, it's verifiable. So I'll talk about that when I've finished it. But again, if you listen back over these podcasts, you leave me saying, like, perhaps some years ago, you know, oh, don't trust Google information. I don't trust Google. But of course, they've found out that our data, which they can extract from us for nothing, is a raw material which they can harness to do predictions of behaviour. It's called behavioural surplus, which they can sell to anybody who wants influence. This enables targeting advertising, such as was used to in the Brexit and in the last general election, from what I can make out. But not only that, you see, it goes further than that. If you've got thousands of data points on citizens. You've got artificial intelligence which enables you to predict the behaviour of citizens, but you can then manipulate that behaviour to go further than prediction, rather than predicting outcomes, actually producing outcomes by getting people to do things. And it's kind of scary. And I say this Peter Phillips outlines how the tech companies are entangled with the Big 17, the transnational capitalist class, but he doesn't go into it to the extent that Zuboff does. And you see there an enormous seat of power concentrated in very few hands. And I'll just mention one thing about that I found interesting, and that when both Facebook and Google were floated on the stock market, there were a lot of the shares that were sold don't have voting rights attached to them. So those shareholders can't vote for a chairman, or they're just shares, you get some profit, that's it. And this enabled the central people in Google and in Facebook to keep all the power. And when you read Zuboff, you realise that there's an enormous locus of power there as well. Well, okay, as I say, I'll talk about that a bit later on. It may be in a couple of weeks or something. I've also read Max Blumenthal's book about the American role in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and the connection of the American intelligence communities with radical Islam, Al-Qaeda and so forth, and ISIS, and it's very intricate. Again, Max Blumenthal is a journalist, I write. He's very good on Venezuela. And he must be onto something, because recently the American state arrested him in the middle of the night and jailed him without charge and without access to a lawyer, to frighten him, I think. They let him out a little bit later. He wasn't charged with anything. But it was a piece of state terrorism, I think, there, enacted on one man who's got a bit near to the bone. Excellent fella. I might talk about that again. Very, very detailed, very intricate. I'll just mention a couple of other things before I leave you. There is an interview with Peter Phillips about his book Giants, it might even just be called Giants, on YouTube, with the excellent Abby Martin, who is a journalist who I write. Look out for that, because he pretty well says everything in that 20 or 30 minute video interview that's mentioned in the book. So if you don't have a lot of time and you want to get the picture, you can look that out. Max Blumenthal has a YouTube channel called The Grey Zone, and so he's an excellent fella. And like Abby Martin, he's good on Venezuela, and Abby Martin's a very good on Venezuela as well. I should mention in this context how much Google is deeply enmeshed with the United States government, and for reasons to do with the US government's desire to surveil the citizens of the US. And I should also mention in this context the immense amount of lobbying that Google does and how much money it throws at it to keep its lawless arena and to stave off attempts to get privacy legislation which would stay its hand a little bit with people's data. Now, just to illustrate, Google is the second biggest lobbyist of the EU, the first being an agglomeration of corporations that acts as one in order to throw enormous amount of money at lobbying the EU and getting favourable legislation. Google is number two in that arena. I'll just mention this because I know probably some of the few people that listen to us are probably wouldn't mind hearing some more of the songs of Yes and No. And I've got quite a few of those in the can, in need of a little polish. And I will try and start getting them out again, because there's absolutely loads of those. And we intend to return to Lao Tzu and just keep plugging away at that. I think we might have done a third of the Lao Tzu, so there's still a lot of work to do there, and we should want to fulfil the promise that we would go through the whole thing. Okay, over and out, and keep listening, and we'll speak soon.